Welcome to Women Waken, a podcast that helps you heal spiritually from trauma in relationships, childhood, and early life conditioning to shift from a place of codependency into a divine feminine state of love, harmony, abundance, and joy. On Women Waken, we begin the journey to waken from the illusion of needing to prove our worth into the divine experience of knowing our worth. I'm your host, Whitney Walker. I'm a licensed mental health therapist, and I specialize in substance abuse, addiction, eating disorders, trauma, and spirituality. I'm also a fellow human being who has experienced most of the issues that I explore on this show. On today's guest episode, I was so excited to sit down and talk with the incredible Monica Berg. Monica is an author of quite a few books, including Rethink Love and Fear Is Not an Option. She was kind enough to send me a copy of the book Rethink Love, and if you listen to the show often, you've heard me reference it and quote it because it's such a fantastic resource for not only finding love and understanding what true unconditional love is, but that journey to being the essence and being the energy that you want to attract, which of course is the only way that we ever really find that soulmate, that true life partner. Monica and I get into a lot of different heavy, powerful topics, including the challenging path through an eating disorder and how to come out of it triumphant and determined to change our lives around, the power of spirituality, specifically the Kabbalah, which principles she includes in her books. We hit on the big three: guilt, blame, shame, the things that hold us back from feeling like we are able to truly love and accept ourselves. We talk about soulmates, authentic love versus ego-based love. We talk about so much on this episode. It's really incredible. So I'm going to bounce and let you all enjoy it. So take a listen and enjoy. Hi, Monica. Welcome to the Women Waken podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you on, Monica. You were kind enough to send me a copy of your book because you're an author, as you know. You're a four-time author, plus you've had quite a few books.
Four. I've authored four books and working on a fifth.
And you do a few children's books, and then you also do some nonfiction books. And I received a copy of your book, Rethink Love: Three Steps to Being the One, Attracting the One, and Becoming the One. Mm-hmm. I love it. I have found it so helpful because it not only helps you when you're thinking about, okay, if I feel ready to find a partner, my soulmate, what can I do? It also addresses kind of aligning more with who you are, which is really the key to finding your true partner.
Exactly. So becoming the one is the first step. And it's usually the step that most people miss because we are focused on external things and very specific goals, right? We go to school, we get educated, we go to hopefully the college, university of our choice, then we get our dream job, and then we find a partner. Unless you're really, really thoughtfully understanding the importance of self-interest and growth and knowing yourself and connecting to yourself and becoming emotionally intelligent, it's not something that's on that list, right? Then the next obvious step would be to find a partner, build a home, buy a house, have children, whatever the case may be. And then what? Then what usually happens is that people start to feel an itch. They're not so satisfied. They're not so comfortable. All the things that they have amassed and attained did not bring them the satisfaction they thought they would, or it's just not enough, right? So then people then go back to, how did I get here? What is it I want? Who even am I, right? So the first eight chapters of Rethink Love is really dedicated, and it doesn't matter. It's obviously easier if you're at the beginning of, you know, you haven't had a lot of serious relationships, or if you're younger, but even if you're married or you're widowed or you're divorced or whatever the case may be, any age, those steps actually need to go back to, because I even speak to people in their 70s and they are asking themselves those same questions, you know, what do I want now? And how did I get here? And what was my life really about? So the first eight chapters are really about the becoming of you, which incorporates, you know, knowing who you are, knowing what you believe, identifying your belief systems, removing shame, blame, guilt. And it's all the things that I did before I found the one. And I intentionally did it because I was going through a very difficult time in my life. And I knew that the only way I could build a happy life for myself ultimately was to become that version of who I was looking for.
And that's really interesting, Monica, because as your story is shared in the book, you met your now husband and got married pretty early. And most of us in our early 20s are not thinking about who am I? How can I become the best version of myself? We might be confused. We might be asking, like, what do I want to do with my life? But not many people are going within and exploring. What do I really want for myself? Not what are the externals that I want to attain to feel like I have a identity. And it sounds like you did that. So what was it that brought that about at such a young age for you?
Well, the truth is, it's human nature. It's one of our seven hierarchy of needs is to feel safe and secure, right? So that searching for that longing for that is very normal and natural. And it doesn't on some level make sense to say, wait a second, before I'm going to do that, I'm going to pause everything and I'm going to really explore self, right? For me, it wasn't really an option, and I'm so grateful for that now. But when I was 18, started almost 17, really, but it became a full-blown eating disorder. I had anorexia at 18, and it lasted for about five and a half years. And people talk about disordered eating. I can speak about anorexia specifically and more precisely. That disorder is really the lowest you get in terms of self-love. You know, you dissect and ridicule and judge every aspect of your being, of your body. You're literally starving yourself, but ultimately you're starving for love and you have a strong desire for control. So I understood on some level that that was obviously a recipe for disaster, but more than that, it took a while for me to see that I had a problem. One day, and I can tell you the story if you want, but one day I actually saw clearly for the first time and I was shocked by what I actually looked like. I saw the skeletal version of me, not what I thought I saw every day, which was like, you know, a fat girl. That's really how I saw myself. And I was a size like double zero. And I started screaming. I was in shock. So once I realized that I was so far from where I wanted to be in terms of loving myself and hearing my voice and removing shame, I knew that I had a problem and I knew I needed to fix it. So no matter how lonely I was or how much I craved and desired love from somebody else, I knew that that wouldn't be fair to bring to somebody else. And I also knew that I would attract the wrong kind of person if I was looking for somebody while I was in that headspace. So for 5 and a half years, I really did that hard work. I started journaling. I started to raise that small, shy, meek voice that was so inaudible because everybody else's opinions were much louder, right? And I started to hear it and I started to have conversations with myself. What is it that I really want? And then to dare to take action and do that. If you saw the 18-year-old version of me, she's unrecognizable. I mean, I found those journals, by the way, not too long ago. And I was so sad for her. I mean, I speak about it like in the third person because I don't even feel I'm not that person, right? And I was like, wow, look how you thought about yourself, you know, and I had a lot of compassion actually for her. So that was the beginning. So, and funnily enough, I met my to-be husband then, didn't recognize him at all as my future husband or soulmate. If God had come down and said, this is who you're going to marry, I would say, absolutely not. Because of where I was at, you know, I was only seeing things in the physical, you know, and with my five senses. And we're very different in the 1% world, but in the 99% world, as I say, is like everything you actually can't see or touch or feel, but it's what makes you kind and empathetic. And it's your belief systems and it's who you want to be in life, right? We are very much aligned. But once I got healthy, then I could actually see him.
Thank you so much, Monica, for sharing that. And I'm so grateful and glad that you were able to move out of that space, of that deep imprisonment that is anorexia. I'm very familiar with it. My mom suffers from it.
Oh,
And
wow.
yeah, and she,
Still? Wow, I'm so
So
sorry.
yeah. And And so it makes me curious about why there are some people are able to, because I also now I'm able to specialize in eating disorders and anorexia and work with people on that as a therapist. And I obviously saw it through her belt. I had an experience, you know, I had an eating disorder for 15 years. And I also sort of had a moment where I realized that this isn't about my weight and it's not about my body. And wouldn't you know, it took 10 years to realize that. I thought I really just wanted a certain body type. That was it. No, nothing else. It wasn't anything deeper than that. I didn't realize that anything, any attachment we have external is always trying to control something that's within. And it all comes down to love, as you said. That's really all it ever is if I just get this right, some part of us believes that maybe we can be loved or we can love ourselves. I think that's more of what it is.
If I'm this enough or that enough, you can fill in the blank, then I will be worthy of, and then fill in the blank. And people search for that their whole lives. Even if they don't have anorexia, it could be a different kind of thing that's plaguing them, right? Did your mom develop anorexia after she had you, or was kind of something that lingered for her throughout?
No, it was
her life?
Before. She also developed it around 18. She was a professional ballerina. And she was able to get well enough to be healthy, to be functional, but she could never really let it go in terms of always keeping that deep restriction, and has stayed at a very low weight, but again, healthy. And she goes to the doctor and she checks out, but she still has to live in that mental imprisonment of having to be that, whether it's that mentality of like the good girl, doing everything right, being perfect so that you can be loved. And it's obviously tragic and breaks my heart. And it makes me think a lot about what it is that other people are able to have, that they're able to have the fortitude to realize that that's an illusion, and that it's something that we're trying to externally fix so we can feel better internally.
Well, let me share with you. I'll be more specific because your story is inspiring me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it sounds like this brings you pain, like your relationship with your mom or her relationship with food and how that affects your relationship as a mother and daughter. I have four kids and I have two girls and two boys. And I always was very aware, because to be honest, if you've had anorexia and you are healthy and you can get healthy, there's still things that stay, like body dysmorphia. I mean, even to this day, if I look in the mirror, I can't see myself accurately. If I take a picture of myself in the mirror, I can see the picture and see what I look like. You know, like those kinds of things. But I was always really aware not to have any, to really enjoy food and make it. And there's always something baked on our counter. There's always like just to make food a healthy, normal experience as it should be, and that it sustains you. But it's genetic, and I can see which kids have the gene. Even, but again, there's not the triggers because we have a healthy home. You know, we have a healthy environment. We have a healthy community. I really try to, because I understood what it is that created that for me to come alive, right, in me. And then I went back and looked at my family members, you know, aunts and mothers, and who in my family, right, had that. So what happened to me is that, and I was never, you know, I was never somebody who was overweight. It was really, my friends were going away to university. My parents are Middle Eastern. They wanted me to stay at home till I got married. I felt very left behind. I felt very out of control. I felt very sad, coupled with all the other things that were going on in our home. My parents were fighting. My father lost as well. There were just so many things. And living in Beverly Hills, you know, I didn't realize this till we moved to New York, but I remember my oldest was 14 at the time. And he said, and he saw that New York City is different. You see it like an eclectic group of all kinds of people, all walks of life. He's like, I never realized how pretty people are in Beverly Hills. Because if you think about it, right, it's a very, that is the environment for the most part. So there was that pressure too. I went to Beverly Hills High School. There's just a lot of pressure. I'm one of three sisters, you know, to be perfect. So when I lost all the weight and I was already thin, and then I lost weight on top of it, I didn't see it at first. And I just kept saying, and this is not even what we're going to talk. Do you want to talk about this? I know we're going to talk about love.
I do. Yeah, we have time.
This is a big part of it.
And I know, and that again, there's people, because this is Women Waken Podcast. Women and food issues are, you know, they go way back and they are commonly, you know, a struggle.
I don't think you can love yourself until you learn to accept yourself. So I do think actually it's part and parcel the same thing. But and there were hints along the way, I think, that we all miss. There were warning signs, you know, But then it became fully developed when everybody went away to school and I stayed behind. And I remember we went back to New Orleans, which is where I was. I grew up as a child. And it was something about seeing the life that we would have had because again, everybody else in my family was kind of d struggling. It was a very dysfunctional environment at the time. And I'm being the middle child, Monica, fix it, Monica, fix it, Monica, fix it, Monica, help this, Monica, do that. And I was like, yes. And I remember it was the last night we were there and we were eating dinner and I just started mushing my food around. And this weird thought came like from behind me saying, oh, I never have to eat again. Yeah. That's what I'm gonna do. And it wasn't even like, it was just the weird, I remember it. It's like almost came from behind me into me. And that was the beginning of it. So, I mean, that's fully when it started. So that went on for 2 years where people were worried, people were talking, I'm saying, no, I just lost a few pounds. Clearly, that wasn't the case. And then that day that I told you about the gift of sight, I saw. So, what the decision I made though, and I think far too often people don't do this, is that once the illusion was gone, the veil was lifted, and I actually saw what I physically looked like. I knew two things. I knew that that vision, what I saw, wouldn't stay. I would see the illusion again. I just had this awakening, which was really a gift from God. And the second thing that came to me and that I lived by is that I understand that we can live lies. We can lie to ourselves so completely that I can never fully trust anything absolutely, which is not a bad thing. It's actually quite a good thing because then you're forced to push the envelope, question yourself, look at things from another angle. So I said to myself, when you lie to yourself tomorrow, you just can't believe it. And that was the beginning of my healing. So I didn't accept where I was as where I wanted to stay. I knew I was miserable, I was lonely, I was unhappy. And I knew that my desire to experience the life I came to live, which is one that does not include suffering. There are certain beliefs I came into the world with that I forgot and then I found again when I found spirituality. I knew that I'm not meant to suffer and this is not meant to be my life. So from that knowing, then I did the steps and I chose health every day. I chose to become a different version of myself.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that that is inspiring to hear because it really does just come down to a choice, right? That we have to make. And I often offer that when I'm working with people, and it can be whether they're in the midst of an eating disorder or a substance abuse addiction, is that there's always two choices every day to act and think in a way that ascertains and relates to your addiction or disorder, or to choose health and to choose recovery. Because every single little thing, as you know, when you're suffering with restriction, it's like, well, maybe I can just skip breakfast. And you're like, it's an innocent thought. It's not. It's down the path of going right back into that safe, sort of cave of a disorder.
So, and I don't want it to sound so simple, like it's just a choice, but it does start with a choice. And to your point, when you have those thoughts, right, this is what everybody is responsible for themselves. When you have that thought like, oh, I'll just skip breakfast, or oh, I'm just going to skip dinner, or I'm going to have no fat today, or whatever the thing is that you're restricting from, pause and say, okay, what is the thought that I'm having, or what happened 5 minutes ago or an hour ago, or what triggered that? There's always a starting point. So I really became an investigator into, because I had to get to know myself. I had to get to know to myself so I could learn to love myself. What is it that is affecting me? What changes my mood? What changes my thoughts? What thoughts are real? What are not even mine? They're just negative belief systems I picked up as a child. So I really started to, as if I was the most curious thing that I wanted to know about, right? Self-interest, because it's not even self-care. It's really being so interested in who you are so you can identify who you want to become, and then you take actions to become that. That's really a formula.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. And I also found it helpful as I was deciding to be healthy and to love myself, was to recognize when the things I were requiring or asking myself were not very nice, right? Like if it was looking in the
It
mirror,
could be
being like,
so mean.
well, yeah, right? Like, well, you can't wear those pants because you look gross. And I would say, that was not very nice.
Who said that?
Like,
Get out of my
not a
head.
very kind thing. Like, why would I want to have that relationship with myself? Is what I started asking. Like, is this how you want to c relate with yourself? Is to be this critical, to be this rude? Do you think that that's conducive to having a loving, safe space within you? And I had to sit there and say, no. But then I realized, but I don't know how not to do it because I had done it for so long. Right.
Right. So I think also what helps, like in those situations, is to focus on what you want. Right. So
Yeah.
let's say you look in the mirror and you're like, you're just so lazy and stupid. You have no discipline. Right. Let's say. And then at the same time, your goals for that day is to, work on a book or whatever it is that you're trying. So if you have that narrative in your head that you're lazy and you're stupid and not disciplined, are you going to manifest your goals? So I think that what happens is if you're super clear about what you want to achieve, and I often teach this, I call it to be versus to do. We're very good at creating lists. Like we have our to-do lists, right? And the list usually, it's not that important. We can take it or leave it. Does it really matter if you do X, Y, and Z on a Tuesday, or you clean the closet, or you might feel accomplished, you might feel good about it, but does it really affect your life? But if you focus on being, I want to be somebody who is kind to myself. I want to be somebody who is strong and compassionate. I want to be somebody who is disciplined and follows through. Then you have your to-do list, right? Because often we try to do things and create things and have goals, but are we the person? Have we become the person that can actually do those things?
Yes, absolutely. And it's such a powerful shift. A quote that I love that relates, I think, to an eating disorder is, I think it's attributed to Coco Chanel. I don't know if it was actually her, but she said, what a, freeing day it is when you decide to be someone rather than something. And that really hit me when I was in eating disorder treatment, was I realized I've always just wanted to be something. But as you're speaking to, when you realize that the most powerful thing you can ever do is decide what you want to be, because that's eternal, that's within you, that has no end. There's no end to how loving you can be. There's no end to how compassionate you can be. How pretty you are, that depends on what other people think. And if you're going to
Also,
go,
if you're going to stay there, like, how are you going to feel when you're 80?
yeah, what do you do then? Just hang it up and hide away?
Not to say people are not beautiful when they're older, but we will change, right? And if you're stuck on like holding and preserving one part of yourself that you think is beautiful and anything outside of that or that's changed from that perfect vision you have for yourself, you will be sorely disappointed.
Yes, absolutely. And so when you make that shift and start thinking about what do I want to be, then you really start to, it can be very exciting because you're like, what do I want to develop? What, and I don't need anything else outside of me to acquiesce and to align with it. I get to invest in it because everybody has love and a heart and integrity, beautiful qualities that are all your own that you can build. And it doesn't make you at the whim of things outside of yourself. And this also aligns, Monica. We can switch back into sort of the love stuff, which is you make the point in your book. You say you can't give what you don't possess. And so often you also speak of the Cinderella complex, how so many of us girls are like, okay, I'm ready. I'm gonna, I, you know, my hair's done. I'm ready for my Prince Charming. But the fact is that if you, when we don't truly possess an ability to love ourselves, we're not gonna be able to give that to somebody else. Because, like an eating disorder, to me, that establishes a sense of conditional love. I like myself when I'm thin. I remember someone saying that in a group. It was, an eating disorder support group. And they said, yeah, but what am I supposed to do when I only love myself when I'm skinny? And it was so simple, but so powerful, as so many people are stuck in that. So, how can we really love somebody else unconditionally if we can't do that, if we don't possess unconditional love? And it's such a barrier for so many people because, again, it becomes external. We think if we look the right way, if we say the right things, we can bring in our soulmate. But that's not, it's not really going to be your soulmate if you're thinking that you can give them something that you can't give or possess yourself.
1,000%, because you attract somebody to the level of what where you're at. And that's why so often people who never really found themselves in the first place, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, like, I don't really have anything in common with this person anymore. Why? Because you didn't look at who you wanted to become. You looked for where you were at in that moment, not thinking, is this somebody that I can grow with? Is this somebody who has the same desire to do whatever I want to do in the future? So it's such an important, again, step where people aren't really looking that far in the future. And you mentioned unconditional love versus conditional love. And I think that it's one of the biggest mistakes we make, right? Conditional love is how a person makes you feel, what they give to you. Even if you don't feel pretty, but they think you're pretty, well, then now you feel pretty. But then if they're not there anymore, what are you going to do, right? So the condition is very much, in exchange, you make me feel, I give you this. Unconditional love is you love somebody simply because they exist. You love their essence, meaning that your desire naturally, because you love them so completely, is to give to them even more than to receive. And then what happens is something really beautiful. Their desire is to give more than to receive. And so then you have the synergy. And I give this story in the book about my father, and I didn't realize it until he passed, but he really offered unconditional love. There was nothing that you, even if we made mistakes, I mean, he was very loud about it and he wasn't always the greatest about how he handled it, but there was nothing we could do, me or my sisters, that would make him stop loving us. And I remember when I was in the throes of anorexia, I had a great idea to hike the Grand Canyon rim to rim in one day. Not recommended, by the way. And he was a diabetic. It was very hard for him. And we went with another friend that was a diabetic and then another friend that was in his 40s. And I later looked this up when I was writing the book, that when should you, what's the best way to hike the Grand Canyon? So they say never do it rim to rim, which is basically you start at the top, you go down to the Colorado River, and then you hike back up, which is it's about an eight-hour hike. Fully with, if you don't stop, which we didn't, we literally did not. And we didn't have enough food, we didn't have enough water. And it was the worst months to go in there. Like, do not go in this window of time, which is when we did it. My point though is, aside from being a very stupid thing to do, it's actually one of the greatest things I did at the same time. But my father, you know, he didn't judge me about what I ate or didn't eat. He didn't question me about my caloric intake. He didn't pressure me in any way. He stood by my side. He saw what I was doing was hurting myself. It caused him pain, but he put me first before himself, right? Which is really, really selfless. And he even did that journey with me, even though he's like, why are you doing this? Why are you indulging this? It's unhealthy for her. And honestly, it was one of the most profound experiences I had. And it was really the most, until that point in my life, I had never felt so loved, really, and seen, because he knew I needed it for a bigger reason. It was a very spiritual trip, you know.
It's beautiful.
So that's how I would explain unconditional love.
Yeah, that's a fantastic example. And I have to say, I was like biting my nails reading that part of the book, because I thought, oh my gosh, you guys did the whole thing in one day, and you were at the heights of your restriction, and he had his own health issues. I was like, oh my gosh, because they do say, they're like, even people of good health and, you know, experienced hikers don't do it. So I was relieved that you all made it out okay.
When I got out, I turned back. It had just turned dark and I saw a bunch of reflective coyote eyes. And I remember I said a prayer. Like, I was like, wow, you know, this is not, it wasn't obvious that this would have ended well, actually.
Wow. That's just an incredible story. And I can imagine that must have been a pretty spiritual experience between you and your dad, and to make it all that way. You must have been exhausted as well. 8 hours of hiking.
Yeah. I mean, I only had a liter and a half of water, 2 liters. And my collarbones dented from the backpack just from that, because I was so emaciated. It's still dented. It never actually came back fully, but, wow. Yeah, I remember sitting, cause then we flew back, cause we were in LA. We flew back to, from Arizona. And I remember just, I couldn't even walk off the flight. After I sat on the plane and then we tried to get off, I was like, oh. But then I later ran marathons. And I guess I, you know, it's part of the head thing, right? Like, I dictate when my body's, that's just what I train myself, I think, through the eating disorder. Like, I tell my body when it's tired, not the other way around. Now I'm much healthier about it, but that was not a hard, you know, it's a lot of this is mental, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing, Monica, about what you described that I think is really beautiful is that story illuminates the idea that unconditional love isn't always very emotive. Like, I love you so much. Sometimes it really is just an allowance of letting someone be exactly who they are, where they are right now, and being and letting them know that they're there with you, and just being a presence, a non-judgmental, allowing presence.
Letting them have their journey, but standing by their side. It's a very hard thing to do. I hear, and I'm sure you do with what you shared earlier with addicts, you know, you see somebody or eating disorder, anytime you see somebody you love harming themselves, right? Often people, I've tried everything, they don't listen. I'm wringing my hands. I can't, I'm not going to indulge this, but they're not doing this by choice. This is not a choice, right? So I think unconditional love, again, it's one of the hardest things to do. But I think, and it's funny because a lot of parents think they do this with their children, like, oh, I love my children unconditionally. Actually, I'd argue that because the truth is they're an extension of you. And you're so proud that this thing that you love more than anything came from you. And you're very invested in how they grow and their outcome. What happens when they hit puberty and they start pushing back? And do you really feel the unconditional love? How does it feel then? You know, I have children at a very big, wide range. And I know all those stages, you know, and unconditional love, really, it's not even loving a child. You think you do, but when they start to go against what you want or what you think they should do, you know, how unconditional is it then? So it's a really great thing to kind of check, I think, for all of your listeners, where are you in the most important relationships you have, especially with yourself, because unconditional doesn't allow for that mean voice, right? Of the nasty self-talk we sometimes do. But how are you in all those relationships? Are you conditional or are you unconditional? And if you're conditional, you know, I would challenge that.
Yes. And I think it's also kind of a surprise to people when it comes to romantic relationships that unconditional love doesn't, again, mean like just always being really attuned with each other and just lovey. It means like even when this person grosses you out, even when they annoy you, that you don't have to love that, but you have that, like you said, you just love loving their essence and saying, like, even if some days you're like, oh my gosh, what did I do? Is this the right one? But it's you still allow for that to be a part of the love you have for them.
Well, it's interesting because to your point, I started teaching this a lot in the last year or two, is that the only real way to have lasting change in this area is first you have to accept all of your flaws, see all the things about yourself that you don't like, and love yourself anyway. You don't have to like those things, but only from love can you then create change.
Yes, definitely. And that has been a big theme for me this year, this idea that even if there's stuff about you that you don't care for, that's okay. It's so I think that, and it kind of goes along with sort of that perfectionist, you know, disordered eating mindset of if I don't like it, it's got to go. You know, you become obsessed with fat. And like you said, you can be stick thin and still think this is
It's
wrong.
never
It's
enough
never enough.
because
And
yeah, this part is still a little bit, you it's just it's at end. There's no winning that game.
And the same goes with our internal world, which is our, you know, our feelings, which I want to get into another portion, maybe my favorite portion of your book align with this, but it's this like, oh gosh, I think I'm actually a really selfish person, or I did this and it was really rude. And so I'm just a selfish, rude person. And I need to get rid of those things, get rid of them. You know, we wouldn't be here if we were perfect. If we were perfect, we'd be back, you know. Up in the one, the whole, we have this human experience to experience what we would consider flaws and to learn to see that they're just a part of the whole as well, that they have their place too, and that we don't need to try and get rid of them.
No, it's such a good point. And I want to challenge your listeners and you as well, because I think that often we think when we identify something, let's say that we perceive as negative about ourselves or a character flaw, sometimes we keep things alive that still aren't the best parts of ourselves. And we do this because we feel like we need to hold on to it for some reason. So let me explain. So if somebody feels like they're rude, right? And they sometimes get embarrassed about how they say things. Is it because they never had a voice and now the only way they know how to say something is by saying it forcefully because nobody ever listens to them, right? So often we create these different things and we keep them there because it's helping us with something else. So instead of judging, right? Oh my God, why am I so rude? So and so so much nicer. I want to be seen like that. Stop and say, okay, why did I behave that way on that specific day? What was it that I was trying to get across? And is there a better way to do it? So it's not that you're a rude person, it's that you chose to express yourself in a way that comes off rude. What are your other options? Right. And it just changes the whole narrative. And then it makes it doable and possible. Then change makes sense. Change actually becomes quite easy because you're not trying to fight your nature. You're not trying to fight against who you are. You're reframing it. And then you're softening it or you're changing it into something else, but you're understanding it.
Yes, and that's very empowering because then you're not feeling like a victim, you're not having that sense of shame, which again ties into one of my favorite chapters of your book is radical accountability. And you call them the big three. the
Yes. Shame. Go ahead.
shame, blame, and guilt,
Yes.
right? And I did an episode on shame, so I spoke to some of your passages, and I love your description for it. Shame means we think there is something so awful about us that if other people discover it, we would no longer be worthy of a connection to them. This is a painful way to live. And that just struck me so much because I thought that's exactly it. You know, when we hold shame about who we think we are, that's we don't want people to see, that we feel like we can't change, it's so painful. And it can keep you in a feeling like you're almost not accountable because it's just there and there's nothing you can do about it, and you get into victim mentality, which just is not a great place to be in.
Well, shame makes people small and it also keeps them stuck. So it's like, oh, don't see me. You're afraid to make a mistake. And then you just don't even move. And those three were such big emotions for me. I really cycled among the three of them for the first part of my life. I was very much that person during the eating disorder. I mean, I felt that all the time. If I make a mistake, oh my God, I feel guilty. And if I ate that, I feel like just nonstop. And then I remember I got to a stage in my life where I was like, I'm never going to feel these emotions ever again. Because if something happens, I can learn from it. So there's no reason to blame, not myself, not anybody else. If I do something and I feel like I made a mistake, well, guess what? I can learn from it and I can do it differently next time. So there's no point to feel guilty about it because it's not, there's no growth or change in that. If I feel shame, well, then I'm not even allowing myself to be. I mean, honestly, once you love yourself enough, that one you just can't feel anymore because what are you ashamed of? You're a human being having human experiences. So all of these, honestly, it is very possible to live a life without ever feeling those emotions, 1,000%. I'm telling you, I was consumed by them. But it really is just you have to go step by step and not be afraid when you have these big feelings, not be afraid of like, oh my God, this is why am I feeling this, or I feel paralyzed by this feeling. Stop and be curious. Like, I cannot say that enough. Be a detective. You know, why am I feeling this? What options do I have to change? What is the emotion telling me? Because any emotion, positive and negative, are teaching us something, especially the negative ones. They are indicators of what we need to change or what we need to pay attention to. But so often they feel so painful, we either push them away, ignore them, run from them, or get overwhelmed by them. Instead, just pause and say, okay, I feel it. It's uncomfortable. You have my attention now. What do I want to do?
Definitely being the curious observer, thinking, whoa, okay. Because here's what's interesting, and you also allude to this in the book, that it's one of those three is usually our go-to response to situations, right? Let's say somebody calls us out and says, hey, what were you thinking? You parked in front of me, you jerk. And some people jump into defensive mode. They blame. What? It's your problem. The other person feels that shock of shame, or they feel sick to their stomach and they think, oh, I knew it. I knew it. I'm a terrible person. I parked in front of them. Just as you spoke to, it has nothing to do with reality. It's just what was maybe imprinted in you emotionally, usually from a young age, that something happened and you're either hypervigilant and defensive, or you take it personally, right? And you feel like it says something about you. So when we get curious, we can see, like, wow, how fascinating. How fascinating that this relatively neutral event happened and I took it this way. And just as you spoke to, we empower ourselves when we decide, I'm going to shift this automatic response. I've identified it. And now, once you identify it, you begin to work to shift it because you realize it wasn't actually true of the situation. It was just sort of what your body has gotten used to doing in those situations.
And it's not really you. It's not the truth that your essence, your soul doesn't have any of these issues. These are just things that have been piled on over years, over time. And if you don't accept it as you, then it's easier also to shed it and to change it.
Yes. And Monica, another thing I want to talk about, because it also kind of comes down to automatic responses and stuff that we're, you know, are ingrained in us, is you speak about the idea of ego-based love. And I want to explore this because I've talked about this a lot on the show, because I had a big aha moment last year where I realized, oh my gosh, these men that I'm interested in, it has nothing to do with my heart or my unconditional self. It has to do with my what I feel is defective or deficient within me. I think they're going to fix it. And that's ego, right? When you're like, please choose me. I hope it works out with this person, but you don't actually consider who they are and if you would ever love them unconditionally, or if you really feel like a genuine connection. It's just like, I want this. I want them to pick me. And to me, that's what ego-based love is. And when I had that awareness, I decided I am releasing attraction to anything that is not love. When it feels like that, could you describe ego-based love where it's like, you know, you get all excited. It's like the roller coaster ride. It's, you know, it's intense, it's invigorating, but that's not really what usually leads to the, you know, long, consistent love.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, when people think about ego, sometimes they get confused because there can be an inflated ego or a deflated ego. It's, and they express differently, right? And we need a little healthy ego, but often the ego is what gets in our way, leads us astray, puts us in the wrong direction, focused on the wrong things. When we look for others to make us better, to validate us, which many people do, it's that will come to an end. It's really honestly never going to end the way that one wants it to. I often say to people, because I a lot of people come to me after they've gone on dates and they're like, they have that narrative, you know, did they like me? What do they think? They didn't call me back after 2 days. And I say, can we just stop and rethink this for a second? Did you like them? Is this somebody you want to spend time with? Would you want this person to be your friend? You are not being interviewed here. It's not like, oh, select me. And I see this a lot with like actors I work with, because they go on auditions and if the person likes them, or so they're used to that, but everybody does this, right? To performing, mm-hmm. to showing the best parts of themselves, which I always say, you know, be you. Instead of thinking, and don't even ask yourself once, what do they like? What do they think? Be present for yourself and say, is this person feeling like there's somebody that's substantial in terms of somebody I'd like to talk to or that I could trust? And I often say to people, ask this question of yourself. Is this person, and you might not know on the first date, but you'll know certainly, you know, within months, because often we stay long past the expiration date. Ask yourself the question, if I imagine the worst day of my life, how would this person show up for me? Because that's how you're going to know if this is actually somebody worthy of your heart and your energy and your time, yes. and your love.
Yes. And could you share with the audience, Monica, I know the story because I read your book, but when you and your husband had that moment in his office where you both simultaneously realized, oh, this is it, and didn't look back, you wouldn't have had that if you went with your initial impression of him, which is, oh, there's nothing romantic. There's nothing. You were, he wanted you to help him with something for work or something. You're like, no, no, can't. And finally, they're so persistent that you did. Fun story. So beautiful. I love it. And you guys describe, which I've heard other people describe, is your hands just cross, like accidentally touch. And there was that zing. There was this connection. There was, and then this knowing of, oh, of course.
Yeah. So, and then we were married 9 months later.
Yeah. And it's wild. And it makes me think about how many people will avoid or not allow for those connections because they're so certain about their first impulse, which is, oh no, not them, for sure not them. So do you think that it was just luck that you guys had that opportunity to have that moment?
I love this question. It's a really important one. I don't believe in luck, but we really both individually did the hard work of becoming the person we needed to be able to be in this relationship. Not everybody wants that, right? People want certain things they look for. And usually, again, it's with the five, it's in the 1% realm. I want to go on somebody who likes to travel or somebody who's athletic like me, or we have things in common, which is great, but that's boring after time, right? After I did this deep work and he was doing the same work because he was studying spiritual wisdom since he was like born practically, and we found the same path, we realized that what we had in common was everything, right? The same belief systems, the same sense of purpose, the same desires of who we wanted to become in life. And we understood we would be the best partners for each other. But again, we did that work individually with the desire to find a partner like that. I think far too often people don't really ask themselves those questions. They think about right now, what is good for right now? Or what is the opportunity? Or what's the smart choice? Or I feel pressure because I'm a certain age, or we have so many other things at play that we don't actually say, okay, I need to take this time to develop me so that I can recognize, so I can see. How can you have clarity and see what's real if you don't know how to trust yourself? You don't know how to see the things that you need to see. And I've done this with many couples. I remember there was one student I had for years, and it was her 30th birthday. And she had taken, by the way, every advice that I had given her in terms of what to work on. She really wanted to get married. And on her 30th birthday, I said to her, you know what? I'm just telling you, you have done everything. You are ready. He's not. you're just waiting for him. It's going to happen this year. Because I'm telling you, she did every single thing, right? And I even set them up that year. And interestingly enough, because it was clear to me that that was her partner, like for life.
Wait,
And
did they already know each other, or you knew him and you knew her and you made the
I knew
intro?
them, they knew of each other, and they were not interested in each other. And I said, I really think you should go on a date. So they, trust me, they took my advice. They got along, but then they didn't. And he decided that he wasn't attracted to her. And he was very vocal about this, and that she wasn't the one. And he was like, yeah, he's not really my type either. They're both tall. So they had that going. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to, if you don't feel it, you don't feel it. But I kept telling, like, because I know their parents, I was like, I'm telling you, cut to a whole year later, literally, suddenly he saw her. Okay. And he's like, I think she's the one. And they started dating, and now they're married and they have a baby. And they're truly, truly for each other. So sometimes people just aren't, one's not ready or one hasn't done the work. Both people, that's why it's so important. I mean, I cannot stress this enough.
Wow. So you're a matchmaker.
Yeah, I don't want that title. It's a lot of pressure. But yeah, I do. I get a sense, especially if I'm around people. I do. I get a sense of what could be. But by the way, there's free will. And if a person
Yeah.
isn't doing the work, then maybe it's not going to happen, like,
Yeah.
and they'll marry somebody else and it's a different reality and it's nice, but it could have been something else too.
Interesting. Also, Monica, I have to ask, is it true that you've really been to over 500 weddings in the past 20 years?
Yes, and counting. I actually just did a show, a relationship show that's coming out in a few months. It's called
Ooh.
Rethink It Relationships. Yeah, it'll be right up your alley because we do a lot of the content from the book, and it's a studio audience, and it's really fun and
What?
animated. Yeah, so I start the
Cool.
whole thing with that. I literally have, and now my husband and I officiate the weddings together. He mostly does, and I have a part in it. And yeah, so I get to see people at every stage, literally, of the relationship, like when they're dating, when they're engaged, the wedding, after. And every energy is different at a wedding. You can really feel the couple, and what's going on.
That's just a lot of weddings. Like, I
It's a
think
lot
I've
of
been
weddings.
to like five weddings in the past 2 years.
I know.
I
I
love
never, for
them.
me, it's so normal. So when I got asked the question, I was like, yeah. But then when I put it into context, like, well, yeah, most people have never, the what, how many would most people go to, I guess, in a lifetime? I don't
Like
know. 10?
15, 20 in a lifetime, maybe. That's
Yeah.
just a lot. I was trying to do the math. I was like, how many weddings is that like a year? It's a lot. Wait, are all these weddings, are they clients of yours, or they're friends, or all the above?
All of the above. Mostly, they're students. We know them, but then we get to know them better and then ultimately become friends. But
Yeah.
yeah.
So I am a little curious. I don't think we've touched on, how did you get into this line of work? Is it because you went through your own journey through, feeling so trapped in your eating disorder to that reclamation of yourself? And then so quickly meeting your husband, it probably just seemed like, wow, I've kind of cracked the case and I'd like to help others see this revelation that I had.
I always had a desire to help people, always. It's very much who I am and what lights me up. Nothing makes me happier than to see people light up and things connect for them and change and grow. Like, really, it's what I live for. So I came into the world like that. And then I was that role in my family, but not in a healthy way. And then I found the spiritual wisdom of Kabbalah. And it was kind of like a rediscovery of things I already knew on a soul level. And I found that at such a young age that it changed the trajectory of my life. Like, it really put me on a path of clear purpose, and of what I want to do. So yeah, I think I just always knew it. This gave me the way to do it. And I also am somebody who really likes to share experiences and what I go through. And I think that helps people, gives them permission to say, oh, wow, I can admit about my past too. And I can admit things that maybe I would have been ashamed about. And I too can change, so everything, whenever I started to have like an awakening or learn something, I would write about it, or I would speak about it, or I, really just became so clear, like, that's what I meant to do.
Well, I know there are a lot of people who are very grateful you decided to do it, because it sounds like you've touched the lives of many people and really helped them in beautiful ways, which is such a blessing. And it sounds like you're truly doing your soul work in this lifetime when you're in alignment and able to help others and help them reach what their dreams are. And I also Thanks for bringing up Kabbalah. That was something I wanted to say that I really appreciate about your book is that you share these various principles, which I wasn't very familiar with the Kabbalah teachings or concepts, and they're beautiful, you know. And of course, they're very akin to other things we hear because, you know, so many of these ideas and philosophies are they have the same little tenets, but they're expressed in different ways. But it's very eloquent and beautiful, the different concepts that are included in this book that are Kabbalah. So it made me curious to explore that more because I
I
liked
love
it a
that.
lot.
Yeah, truth is truth, right? So, and for me, and the other thing I really do want to stress upon in relationships, it doesn't matter what religion you are, it doesn't matter what spirituality you practice, but I think to have a healthy relationship that is constantly growing and allows for the love to get deeper and stronger every year, there really does need to be a spirituality. Because if not, the ego takes control, and the ego is the third party in the room, and ego likes to be right, and ego causes separation. So that's why I felt it was really important for me to share my spiritual practice, but it could be any practice, but it's so important to have in a relationship.
Yes. And speaking of, we can talk about your podcast, the Spiritually Hungry podcast, which I believe you do with your husband.
Yes.
Oh, what a treat. I would love to hear you two together now that I feel like I've heard so much about him.
You should. It's funny because it's not a relationship podcast. However, a lot of the comments we get are, wow, it's so fun to hear you guys. We banter a lot. We laugh a lot. We challenge each other. And they said it's really great to hear and see a healthy relationship because a lot of people don't have that model. And that we talk about everything under the sun and many different topics, but that exchange is something that, from what we've been told, is refreshing for people and inspiring.
I'm sure. How long have you been doing it?
I want to say 3 years now, maybe two. It was a COVID project.
Oh, a
So
COVID baby.
yeah, exactly.
I love it. Okay, so you have the show that you're going to start producing, the one that has a live audience that's
It's
reading
produced.
love.
We're gonna release it in April or May, so
Is
soon.
it like online or
That's to
TV?
be determined. Hopefully
Okay.
TV, but it will be out there. Rethink it. Relationships. Yeah, I actually really would. I want you to reach out to me after you see it. I think you'll really, especially with everything you've shared, I think you'll really enjoy it. Our podcast, and then I have our second children's book, The Tale of the Other Glove, coming out in the fall.
Oh, what's that about? Is it just like a fun children's book, or are they woven into like your spiritual concepts?
Well, everything is going to have a spiritual bend. It's not outright, and obviously it's a children's book, but I co-authored it with my youngest child, Abigail. And she's the narrator. So the first book is The Gift of Being Different. And it's about how our differences are actually our superpowers. And we just have to reframe and rethink how we feel about them and how we feel about being different. So it's a lot of like self-acceptance. Abigail has dyslexia. And at first she didn't want it. And then she changed it and how she saw it. And she got so excited about it. It changed the way that she feels about herself and the way she views life. So, Tale of the Other Glove is about unhoused people. So, each book is about something that's happening in the world or in ways that people are afflicted, and then the elevated spiritual way of thinking about it or reconsidering it. So, it's about unhoused people, and it's the power of empathy and how we can all do more than we think we can. Even one person can make a difference. So, it's Abigail's journey through New York City where something happens with a glove and an unhoused person. And yeah.
We're just going to have to read it, find out what
Exactly.
happens. How beautiful. Well, Monica, thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you for putting these beautiful resources out into the world. I really can't recommend Rethink Love Enough. I have to get your other books now because now I know I will love them. My listeners have heard of this book because, again, I've referenced it in several different episodes at this point since I first got
Love
it.
that.
So appreciate you so much. And congratulations on this amazing. And also, you know, you're incredible to have had this lifetime that you have and to have that conviction and to make this shift and then to help so many people. So thank you and congratulations on this beautiful adventure of yours.
Thank you so much. It's been fun talking to you.
And if people would like to find you, learn more about you, if they want to get some of your books, listen to your podcasts, where can they find you?
My blog is rethinklife.today, and my social handles are Monica R. Berg 74.
Perfect. All right, Monica. Well, this has been such a pleasure. Maybe I
Thank
can
you.
have you back on after your show airs and you've got all kinds of new stuff going on. We'll have you back and we can chat some more.
Yeah, I'd love that. And check out Fear is Not an Option, my other book. I think you'll enjoy that. And we can talk about fear and all the things that come along with that.
I can't wait.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Bye.
That wraps up our episode for today. Thank you so much for listening to Women Waken. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and come back for more. If you'd like to connect with the Women Waken community, you can find us on Instagram at Women Waken. And if you follow Women Waken, you can get a free tarot card reading if you just send a DM. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and don't forget to let your unique light shine into this world.